We're here studying the book of Genesis, maybe the most crucial book in the whole Bible. And last week we started talking about the notion of creation, a notion which we saw there's a fair amount of evidence, really, that a creation, a special creation by a personal God did happen, and that that's the best explanation for why we're here. And of course, not everyone accepts that position. A lot of people think that the world we're living in just kind of happened this way, and that natural forces can explain everything. Tonight we wanted to think about, okay, you can go a couple of ways on this. You can believe in a special creation by a personal God, or you can believe that the forces of nature just sort of happen to have, you know, run this way, and we've got a chance configuration on our hands here. But whichever way you go, there's certain implications that flow out of that. And we want to talk about that tonight, because I think it becomes a very powerful argument, really, in favor of creation. And it also leads to deeper questions about the nature of the human race and the nature of the God that must have created that race. Let's look back at this passage. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And that's our basic thesis, is that we are in a created world here. Whether that's true or not, we need to think about that long and hard. And I also want to jump down then tonight to verse 26, where God says, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. And let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and the cattle over all the earth and over every other creeping thing that creeps on the earth." And God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And so the Bible declares that humans have been created, quote, in the image of God. This is probably one of the most important concepts in the whole Bible. It explains so much. The theology is loaded on the back of this one claim right here in Genesis chapter 1. It's crucial that we understand what it means and whether we believe it. The claim that humans have been created in the image of God flatly contradicts, of course, all naturalistic theories, which would argue that humans are basically just like the rest of nature. We're just one more creature that has arisen up out of the prebiotic soup along with all the others. It's nothing different. The Bible is telling us here, no, actually what you have with humans is you have a creature that is unique on the earth, because we're the only ones that have been created with this nature that is analogous to, that is in the image of Creator God. In the New Testament, this is taught as well. And in one important passage, Romans 1:19, Paul says to us, "That which is known about God is evident within people, because God made it evident to them." In the context of this, he says you can really tell pretty much a lot about God by looking at what has been made out in nature. And that's kind of what we were talking about last week when we looked at all those super complicated, you know, molecular structures that make up cells and stuff like that. And we're saying, you know, you look at it, something like that, and that tells you that there must be a creator God right there looking at it, nature. But here he goes on in this passage and says, also, though, when you look within, when we look inside of ourselves, we see evidence there that we were created by an infinite personal God. God, he says, has made it evident within ourselves that he's there and that we have been created in his image. Now, let me explain how this works. We're going to be talking tonight about the evidence from internal consistency, or what could be called the argument from presuppositions. Don't be frightened by that big word. To presuppose something means that, you know, you have certain starting points in your thinking, everyone does, where you just assume certain things to start with. Like you may assume that your eyes are seeing a real world out here. There are assumptions that we have to make in order to address the world and to deal with it. And those assumptions are not themselves proven necessarily. We just start there and reason out from there. Those are our presuppositions. We presuppose those things before we even start thinking. You know, so everyone has presuppositions, but not everyone has ever really sat down and thought about what are my presuppositions and what are the implications of those presuppositions. And that's too bad, because if we did think a little bit more about that, we'd come across some pretty amazing things. You know, a lot of times people say that they believe this, I believe in that, and I believe in the other thing, yet if you watch their actions, it doesn't look like they're telling the truth. A lot of times our actions may demonstrate that we really believe in something different than what we say. And I always believe that, you know, actions speak louder than words in a lot of ways. When our actions contradict our claimed beliefs, then that suggests that we got a problem on our hands, that we're either confused about what we believe, we think we believe one thing, but our actions show that we really believe the other thing, or often, I'm afraid, it means that we're actually dishonest and that we are not willing to admit what we believe in, maybe sometimes even to our own selves. Let's see how this works. Let me give you a couple of examples tonight. And this gets just a little bit complicated, but it's so cool that I think if you stay with us on this, you're going to be really glad that you did, okay? Because I just think this is so powerful. Here you got a friend who says that he doesn't believe in gravity. Gravity has no effect on him. And yet, you go flying in a plane and you notice he's wearing a parachute. And you're like, hey. You're wearing a parachute right now. I thought you said you didn't believe in gravity. You should be able to jump out of this plane without a parachute and just float or whatever. And he's like, yeah, I just wear this, you know. I like the way it looks. We're not going to let somebody off with something like that, are we? You know perfectly well why he's wearing that. It's because if he jumped out of the aircraft, he'd perish. And his actions are showing that he believes the same thing you do. That his elaborate claim to believe the other thing is not really true. Here's another one, okay? Your friend says that he's all concerned about the environment. But then you notice one day you see him out back by the stream behind his house pouring his dirty oil out from his car into the stream out there. And you're just like, oh man, could he be so confused that he doesn't know that that's not good for the environment? Is it possible that he could be that confused? Or is it that he really doesn't give a daggone thing about the environment and, you know, that's all talk? Either one of those would be good possibilities. But it definitely is a problem, because you got a flat contradiction between the way he acts and what he says he believes in, right? Now, we call that hypocrisy, when your life doesn't match up with what you believe. And most people are pretty down on hypocrisy, but frankly, there's a lot of it around. And particularly when we come into this area that we're going to talk about tonight. I'm going to give you a third example, okay? Here's a story that we're going to think about tonight. These two guys are riding in a train. I hope you can see that. These two guys are riding in a train, and a train pulls into the station. They're sitting at a little diner table across from each other. They look out their window, and they see this, a hillside with little rocks all over it. And right on in the middle of the hillside, it looks like these rocks are arranged in a pattern that seems to say the Canadian Railways welcomes you to Canada. Well, the one guy says to the other one, man, can you believe that? Somebody spent a lot of time piling those rocks up like that. I'm just surprised that they would take the time to do that. The other guy says, well, you know, I don't know about that, actually. You can see that there are a lot of those same types of rocks scattered around on the hillside. And, of course, with the slope of the hill, gravity and erosion, it's not hard to imagine these rocks migrating down the hill, rolling at times, Who's to really say that they didn't just happen to roll into that particular configuration? And so you're like, the first guy's like, okay, so you're kidding, right? You don't really think that that happened by accident. Oh yeah, you know, it's entirely possible. I mean, everything's there. The material's there, the energy's there. And look how many hillsides there are around here. I mean, maybe it doesn't happen on all of them, but it's bound to sooner or later happen on one of them. I mean, over millions of years and everything. And so they're going back and forth along these lines. Now, what we're dealing with here is what we were talking about last week. It's the argument from design. And it's very far-fetched, in most of our opinions, would be very far-fetched to say that that kind of configuration of rocks could have happened by accident. And it just happens to look like English letters and words. Those kind of things don't happen by accident. No, that's not possible. And so, I mean, I'm sure I would put up a pretty heavy fight. By the way, let me just stop here for 1 second. Which would be more likely? Which would be more probable? That this might have happened by accident? Or that those extremely elaborate molecular devices we saw last week could have happened by accident? Frankly, I could believe in this happened by accident way easier than that. Because that is probably a million times more complicated than anything we're seeing here. But we already know that this is complicated enough that that is not going to happen by accident. I'm convinced anyway. And so we argue back and forth. Now, let me also make another footnote while we're here too. On the argument from design, if these rocks were placed there, then we can also draw certain conclusions about the type of being that put them there, right? Notice that the rocks, if they were placed by like this by someone, then that one who placed them must be a thinking, planning, willful being. I mean, they executed a plan to make this come out this way. And that is to say that a being that would give us a result like that must be a personal being. And that's part of what we're going to have to try to come to grips with here tonight. What does it mean to be a personal being as opposed to an impersonal entity? You know, a lot of people conceive of God as an impersonal force, like in Star Wars, the Force be with you, right? That is not an unusual conception of God, that God is in everything and that he's impersonal. But an impersonal God like that would not explain the presence of apparent design like this at all. Gravity is an impersonal force. And that's exactly what we're saying will not account for the rocks being in that shape there. And neither would an impersonal God account for it. It wouldn't be any better. To get something like this, you really need someone who can think about what they're going to do, set out on a plan, and willfully go out and accomplish that plan. And those are things that have to do with persons, personal beings, not just forces. Yeah. Well, anyway, this is the argument from design. I think it's pretty powerful, frankly, but that's not all we have. There's more here. Now we want to take this up another step. Okay? So you're in the train here and you're arguing with the guy and you're like, well, that's just the stupidest thing I've ever heard. You know, and I can't believe that an intelligent person like you believes that, but I'll tell you, just all right, whatever. You believe it's there by accident. I know I'm going to stick with my view that it's been put there by somebody. So we go on then. Maybe doing some other things. And a few minutes later, the guy, the one that thinks it's there by accident, says, hey, we had to get into the station here and convert our money over to Canadian. And the first guy is like, why should we do that? And he looks out the window and he's like, can't you read? We're coming into Canada. Okay. Now just hold it right there. Now, it's one thing to say that these rocks got to be there by accident, that they just rolled down the hill and happened to be there in that shape.
But now the same person who claimed a minute ago that that is an accidental configuration of rocks on the side of the hill is now ready to read a meaning into that accident based upon which we're going to go change our money over to Canadian. In other words, that this means we're entering Canada. No. No. The idea that the rocks came into that shape by accident is improbable. But if you assume that they did come by accident, then the idea that that means that you're entering Canada is impossible. Not improbable. It's impossible to reach that conclusion based on that assumption, right? And this is the argument from presuppositions. The second part. It takes things to a different level. It's a little bit more complicated, but I think it's even way more powerful, frankly, than the argument from design. Because we're talking about something, a conclusion here that is really inescapable. And the longer you think about it, I think the more powerful it gets. We're saying that you cannot argue that this happened by accident on the one hand, and yet claim that it means something on the other hand. Those two assumptions flatly contradict each other just as much as the guy pouring the oil in his stream. And if your life and your worldview is based on the assumption that the world makes sense and has a meaning, even though your assumption is that it all happened as a chance accident, you are in a state of self-contradiction and really of hypocrisy as severe as anything we've described so far. Let me show you how this works. Let's think through several areas of, you know, philosophical thought, just daily thought. I mean, things that we have to deal with. Like, for instance, meaning. This question, does your life have any meaning or any value? See, I think most people believe that our lives do have meaning and they do have value. But what we have to see is that you cannot reach the conclusion that your life has meaning and value in any ultimate sense unless you're the product of special creation. That is necessary. You know, if humans just happened, then our existence has to be, by definition, ultimately meaningless. It's just as necessary, no different than the rocks on this hillside. If those rocks can't have meaning if they just fell there by accident, then you, also a product of an accident of molecular collision, are just as meaningless. And to turn around and to read meaning in flatly contradicts your own presuppositions. Now, here's the deal. This is a very important point here. If your life, your actions, and words contradict your own claimed, you know, belief system, then I've argued that that is hypocritical at that point, so that's bad. But let's go even further. What if you want to live in harmony with your assumptions, but you're unable to live in such a way that your life is compatible with your own presuppositions? For instance, let's say that you're an aircraft designer and you're like, man, I'm going to create the most far out aircraft ever. It's just going to be shaped like a ball. It's just going to be like a flying ball. I wonder why no one's ever done that. You can't do that. It's because aircraft have to be shaped a certain way because they're dealing with the physics of airflow and lift. You can't just shape an airplane like a ball and have it fly. Aircraft have to deal and interact with the real world. And that's why we can't just make them any way we want. We have to make them in a way that actually works in the real world. So if your assumptions are such that you cannot live in accordance with them, what does it suggest? It suggests that your assumptions are so false that they simply don't work in the real world. And that's why you can't. It's not that you don't want to live in conformity to them, but you're just unable.
it implies that your assumptions, your presuppositions are false. So false, they cannot be lived with.
And that, I think, is, well, now, well, that's powerful. That's important to think about right there. Let's take another area. Let's take like an area like morality. The belief that there's such a thing as good and evil, moral good and moral evil. Most people believe in this. I mean, they're not necessarily saying that I am always a good person, or that there might not be issues which are in the gray area that could be under dispute, but that there certainly are some things that clearly, you know, when we think of somebody capturing and raping and killing a three-year-old girl, you're not going to get a whole lot of argument anywhere that such an action is wrong. That's just morally wrong. Even if we pressed the issue and said, you know, but is it really wrong, or is that just our society's view that it's wrong? Most of us know perfectly well in our heart, no, doesn't matter what society says, that is wrong, period. Right? What Hitler did to the Jews is wrong. And there is such a thing as wrong. No matter how much he denied that it was wrong. He claimed that was okay what he did, but he was wrong, and they were all wrong that did that. Now, that belief that moral right and wrong exist. Suppose we have a piece of paper here, and a little breath of wind came along and catches the paper, and it flutters down to the ground. Is that event morally good or morally evil? Ask yourself that. It can't be morally good or evil, right? Because a paper is just a material object, and the wind would be matter as well. You have gravity. You really have natural law acting on matter. If it's just matter being affected by natural laws and the forces of nature, you can't get a moral concept out of that. That's amoral. You know, is it morally good or evil that the moon is going around the earth? There's no morality there. That's just the way it is. Now, realize, if we come from a naturalistic position, if we deny the supernatural element in the creation of the universe, then all the universe, including you and me, are matter being affected by natural law. There is no exception to that. In a naturalistic position, there is no supernatural, only the natural. And matter reacting to physical laws cannot be turned into morality. We can pretend that something's moral, but all the time we know in the back of our minds, we just made this up and there's really no such thing as moral right and wrong. Now, a lot of, you know, naturalistic philosophers have seen this pretty clearly and have admitted it. But frankly, very few people ever lived this way. Even some of the sharpest atheistic, non-believing philosophers like Jean-Paul Sartre, he betrayed his own position. He was a great one for pointing out that you really can't devise morality because there's no such thing as God. And he's very profound on that. I mean, he's one of the best for pointing that out. Everything is arbitrary. But then toward the end of his life, he signed a protest manifest against the Algerian War and showed moral indignation and outrage. He betrayed his own presuppositions. Yes, that was hypocritical for him to do that. And so it goes. All of us essentially are the same way. We can't avoid morality, even though our worldview indicates we should. Under naturalism, under the belief that the natural is all there is, then whatever is right. And you cannot moralize about it whatsoever. Now, on the other hand, people who believe in an infinite personal creator God, we do believe in morality. And the reason is because God, the Creator, Himself a moral being, created us and imparted this capability to know and to experience moral right and wrong. That in fact, the universe itself has a moral dimension to it because its creator is a personal moral being.
And so there's nothing inconsistent about believing in moral right and wrong if you believe in that infinite personal God. That doesn't imply that we necessarily live morally, as I said earlier, but rather it shows that there is such a thing as morality. Pantheism, and I'm going to just briefly take a few shots at pantheism tonight. Pantheism means, pan means everything, and theo is God, that everything is God, or God is everything. The view that really embraces a very large proportion of the human race believes that that God is like in everything. So, you know, literally in the stool here is part of God, and so it's more like God is a force and so forth. And in pantheism, interestingly, they wind up in the same position that the naturalist does, that denies the supernatural. Because in pantheism, God is a part of the best person that ever lived, the Mother Teresa's of this world. He is also just as much a part of Hitler as he is anyone else. God is as much in the evil of this world as he is in the good. And that's why many Eastern masters teach that good and evil is the sickness of the mind, that these kind of dualities are really unenlightened thinking, because it's all part of the whole and the universal all. And so we find, though, that the same person that comes from that pantheistic Eastern or New Age perspective that believes that God is all will turn around and say, you know, racists really make me sick, and there, that is immorality right there. And then what we have is, once again, that self-contradiction between our actions and our worldview. Let's take another area, human dignity. A lot of us think that humans are important for some reason. How many of us would reach to swat a mosquito that was biting us and think, oh, wait a minute, that's a living being. You know, I better not. I'll just let him have his dinner. Not me. I'd swat him, and I'd be glad I got him, too. And I think most of us feel that way about it. Well, why would we do that to a mosquito, but we're not willing to do it if a human is annoying me, and why don't I just swat him or her as well? What's the difference? The size? That's it? If they're both material entities, if they're both sacks of chemicals of different size, what's the difference between one or the other? Some people I've posed this question to people before, they're like, well, you know, that's our own species. So, a lot of species kill their own, eat their own. You know, I mean, what difference does it make whether there are species or another species? It's just a material object. Some thinkers, naturalistic thinkers, you think of the Stalins, you think of the Maos, even the Hitlers of this world have realized this, and that was why they were willing to kill millions of people. To them, they're just material objects that are in the way. Just eliminate them. No big deal. And so they were consistent, even though those same people then would turn around and devise a different morality. You know, Mao and the rest of them, they would describe their own moral standards that were just as contradictory. But some people try to live in a way that's fitting. You just ultimately can't do it. Why do we say that all people are equal? That's a belief that's so widespread. And yet, on materialistic grounds, we look at this gal over here. She's shorter than me. We're not equal. I'm this tall, she's that tall. I'm a man, she's a woman. That's not equal. That's different. I'm stronger than she is, so we're not equal there either. Why can't I just beat her and take what I want, take her money or whatever? The belief that all people are equal is absolutely bound up in the theory that all people have been created in the image of God. That's the reason that they're equal. Physically, naturally speaking, they're not equal at all. And so, there's a big contradiction there when people are naturalists and yet they still argue that all people are equal. Without a personal and spiritual dimension, all of these are nonsense. We, of course, who believe in God, say that humans are significant because they're created in the image of God and as personal beings.
created at this high order by God in a way that's analogous to himself, then we're just more significant, whether for good or for evil. There's an interesting twist there. That in the idea of being created in the image of God, it elevates our significance of our decisions, become meaningful, even not just in the good sense, but also in the evil sense. And that explains why you will find humans committing atrocities that other animal species would never think of doing. Is exactly because of this same thing, this high level, this high order that which we've been created. And we're going to talk about that next week. Of course, in pantheism, again, you have a problem with human dignity. Because in pantheism, humans are nothing special. You know, God is a part of humans, but he's also a part of every other aspect of the natural order. And people often in the West will look, for instance, at a village in India where starvation may be killing people, especially children. And yet there are cattle, monkeys, and other animals there competing, and they will not slaughter those animals and feed on them or even remove the rats away from eating the grain. Because according to their worldview, the human has no right over any of these other animals to lay one of them to waste. Now, many of us in the West think, well, that's beautiful, you know, because that is so compassionate toward animals. And I just love that because, you know, it's not mean like we are here in the West. Well, I kind of agree with what Francis Schaeffer said about it. He said, you know, the problem with India, it's not that they really raise the cow. It's that they lower the human. You know, because, again, if you're going to let your own children die rather than go out and put this cow, who's probably also starving, it's not humane, and it's a value system that I think is very problematic. And so humans really don't have a special place in that system. Let's think of another area, freedom of action, freedom of thought. Are you deciding what you want to do because you make decisions, you think about it and decide what to do, or are you being made to do what you do because everything's determined for you? That's an interesting one. Let's think about the old experiment with vinegar and soda. Okay, if we take some soda and put it in a glass and pour vinegar in there, you know what happens, it foams up, right? And that's because these are two chemical reagents which coming together, you know, the valence of the compounds and so forth, it dictates that this is going to happen. No matter how many times we do this, the same thing happens each and every time we do it. And we can predict down to the finest measurement exactly how much CO2 is going to be released here and so on. In a million trials, there won't be a single time that the exact same thing doesn't happen as long as the components are the same. What we have here is a rigid material machine of cause and effect. There is no choice, no freedom of choice on the part of the soda or the vinegar as to what I think I'll do this time. They will do exactly what chemical, natural law dictates that they will do. Exactly that and nothing else. Cause and effect. And to the naturalist, the entire universe is made up of matter reacting to natural law. In other words, the whole universe is a machine just like that picture of the soda and vinegar. Chemicals reacting under the influence of, you know, you have energy transfer, you have basically the principles of physics, chemistry, and so forth dictate exactly what one cause is going to lead to a certain effect, and that sequence is unbroken and unbreakable right on down the line. Now, if that's true, and this sequence of cause and effect explains all things, then that would include your thoughts are also a part of that cause and effect sequence in a material world. What happens when you think, after all? Chemical reactions, the chemistry at the synapse of the nerve, electrical impulses that are driven by the data of your senses and probably your past history and your genetics. Of course, it's much more complicated
than the vinegar and soda. We say, well, that's a lot more complicated there. So, it's still just chemicals reacting together and electrical impulses. It's all driven by the physical properties of the universe. There is no way that we can describe how do we get freedom out of something like that. And that's why a lot of naturalistic thinkers have been honest enough to point out that really what we think we're making free choices, they're not free. Then in fact, we're determined to be a certain way. Well, of course, without freedom, then neither can there be such a thing as human moral action or moral responsibility. You can see this thinking rising in the West, where we'll see somebody commit an atrocity or some crime or something like that, and people will be like, yeah, but look at the upbringing the person had and so forth. And, you know, culture basically probably made the person that way, so, you know, they couldn't help it. And there's a growing sense that we can't really hold people responsible because, I mean, after all, their environment, you know, caused them to be this way. Although then the same person that believes that, when we turn around and there's certain heinous crimes committed, we'll be like, oh, he should be killed for that. We have a hard time being consistent with a position like this. But truthfully, the more you think about it, if there is nothing but matter in this world, then how do we get this idea of people freely deciding, I'm going to do this, and I haven't been programmed to do that in any way? You don't. And of course, if people aren't free to choose what they're doing, then how can we blame them for what they're doing? They're only doing what they have to do. We think of somebody hitting the keyboard in an underground bunker somewhere and launching the next nuclear war. Who's to blame? The keyboard? Is the keyboard to blame? It can't be the keyboard that's to blame. The keyboard is a machine. It does what it's made to do. We follow back through the keyboard to the finger belonging to the last free-choosing moral agent. That's the one that's to blame for what happened. We all see this. I believe all of us see it. And yet, do we see the implication of that? How do we get freedom in the midst of a purely mechanistic, materialistic universe? You can't have meaningful love, according to this worldview. Yeah, because what is love? I feel like I love this person. According to naturalism, that is a chemical reaction in your brain, probably related to the herding instinct or the breeding instinct. To read any kind of transcendent meaning into that is pure fiction, nothing more. Under naturalism, everything is predetermined. What is going to happen is going to happen. There's nothing you can do about it, and therefore nothing matters. Doesn't matter what you do. Everything is meaningless under this worldview if we're consistent with our presuppositions. But nobody can live that way. Nobody does live that way. And so we're forced, like the person who thought, maybe I'll make a round airplane, we find out, this thing don't fly. And so we change to a different model that does fly because we cannot live in conformity to those presuppositions. We're just unable. Every time we protest a rapist or a racist, we're showing that we believe that they're not determined to do what they do, but they're really free on some level. And that's why we protest it and feel outrage about it. Christians, on the other hand, theists who believe in an infinite personal creator God, we argue that people were created with this capacity to make free choice by a God who himself is free to do whatever he wants. He has freedom, and therefore he created humans in his image and gave them this capacity to decide something. Not that they were programmed to do it, but they just decide what they want to do. And we also believe that that freedom has been impaired because of things that have happened since creation, that we've actually lost some of the freedom that we should have. But that it's still there to a meaningful extent, and that we can make free choices. And there's nothing inconsistent about that. We're not contradicting our own presuppositions when we hold that people can make free decisions. Especially the decision whether they want to come to God or not. Pantheism, on the other hand, it's got a problem with free choice. Pantheism teaches that everything happens because of karmic law, and the actions in previous lifetime are dictating what happens now. That's why there's no point in resisting the present order or trying to change it in any way. The key is just to be completely passive in the face of it, you know, because you cannot violate karmic law. Well, I'm not going to dwell on that. It's too complicated. Let's go on one last area. Spirituality. The belief that people have a spiritual dimension, or an afterlife, shall we say, too, that you will live on after your body dies. I hope we all see that that is only possible under a theory of special creation, that it is not possible under a theory of naturalistic evolution, right? How could a purely material process like evolution suddenly leap, jump over from matter into non-matter? You know, it's not like when you die, like part of your matter goes on to live on. It's your spirit that lives on. If you believe that humans have a spirit, that's a non-material entity. So how could molecules give rise to something that's not even material? That's impossible. How could the natural result in the supernatural? Without any guiding hand, no outside influence, just on its own, suddenly matter, and then all of a sudden non-matter. No, that is not possible. No, it's not possible that humans evolved to a certain point where they were just getting more and more advanced, and all of a sudden they just had a spirit. No, that's not possible. And so on it goes. There's really many more areas we could go into. But I hope you see the pattern here. Let's try to wrap this up. What am I arguing? I'm saying when we believe that people are meaningful, that they're significant, that they're free, that they're moral beings, then we have to also admit that a purposeful God created them that way. You must admit the one if you believe the other. Or to put it differently, all of these features that we're using, all of these adjectives here, are incompatible with a chance origin. Just like the guy on the train who's going to say, let's change our money because the rocks say that we're entering Canada. No, you can't do that. It's totally... Hey, when you think about it, those rocks on that hillside, if they're anywhere near the Canadian border, that would really put a wrap on it right there, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it? It'd be bad enough if something like that happened on any hillside on the earth. But if it's sitting on the Canadian border and it says that, oh man, that's it. End of discussion. It's all over. And that's really what we have right here. When we look at the implications of special creation by a personal, infinite God, and where that happens to lead us, and the implications of a naturalistic origin, or even a pantheistic origin, none of these are compatible with pantheism either. And so we find ourselves boxed into a corner, where if we're going to be honest with ourselves, we're going to have to admit what the Bible says is true. That we are here as a product of special creation by a personal God. And the thing is, we all do know that these things are true of us. Now, we may try to deny it. You know, and people do try to deny it because you don't have to be Einstein to sense where this is headed. You know, you start admitting things like this about people, and even those of us that are pretty simple, you can tell where this is headed. And that's a motive right there that people sometimes have for not wanting to admit it to the obvious. Here's a way to summarize it. The way you view the origin of humans controls absolutely the way you view the nature of humans. If we arose as an accident of nature, we're one thing. If we're here created by a personal God, we're a different thing. And our own actions show that at some deep level, every one of us know in our heart that a personal God must have made me, because we all consent to the features that are only compatible with creation by a personal God. And so it's true then what Paul said in Romans chapter 1, that God has, quote, made himself evident within us. He says in that passage, people, even that have never read the Bible before, know that God is there, and they know he's personal, and that he's not an impersonal force, too. They know all that for one reason, because they can look right inside their own selves, and what do I see in there? I see a personal being, myself. The impersonal didn't give rise to the personal. You know, if you were out in the mountains and you looked up a valley and you saw a lake here and a higher lake up here, I've seen that before, you know that the higher lake is feeding the lower lake. It's not the other way around. We all know that. And we all know in our heart, if we want to be honest with ourselves, I am a personal being, and that did not arise from the impersonal. But it was created by a personal God. Well, okay, now you start saying that, and it makes some of us nervous because we're thinking, wait a minute, you know, if that's true, the next questions that come up, who is this God? What's he like? And that makes us nervous because we're thinking, I'm scared of that. I don't know if I want to face that. This question, how can you get to know him personally and live with him forever? That's where this is headed. Right there. And now we're talking about something pretty applicable. This isn't off in the library of the philosophical school here. When we start asking that question, this comes right into the living room. Am I going to go on into a future that is with this God that created us? Is that possible? Can I do that, and how? And now we're right down in ready to read the book of Genesis. Before we even get any further in Genesis, because we're not going any further tonight, let me just suggest that you don't have to even wait till next week. Start tonight by simply saying, you know, if it's possible that a God is there like this, a personal God, speak to him, call out to him, and say, if you're there, if you're real, show yourself to me. Could you do that? Yes. Because he's a personal being. He would hear what you're saying. The Bible tells us, if we can believe anything in the Bible, that God is real. It's not just a religious belief that we happen to have, but that he's actually there. Boy, creation takes us there, doesn't it? When we think of those rocks on the hillside, the question isn't, who do I believe put the rocks there? The question is, you know, somebody put them there. And that's who we need to deal with, is the one that actually did it. In the same way with creation, someone actually created this place. And that's who we need to deal with. So what matters is really who is that? And we should be able to call out to him and say, you know, I'm interested in knowing you. I want to know you. Reveal yourself to me. And God is such that he will hear you say that and he will answer you. And over the next number of weeks, if you say this in your own heart, you don't have to come up and kneel at the altar, okay? Nothing like that. Just in your heart, let God know, I'm interested in knowing you if you're there. It's actually kind of hard to even say that because, you know, I mean, I come from an atheist perspective myself. I was into that. And it was a real strain for me to kind of force out the words, speaking to a God who I had been denying it during the years prior to that. I think it was kind of a blow to my pride. But I could not explain to myself why I wouldn't be willing to do that. You know, sometimes people will see this momentarily and quickly look away because we just don't want to think about that possibility. It bothers us. And if anyone is going to take that position, welcome to the life of willful, knowing self-deception. How does it feel to willfully look away from something you clearly sense could be true and could be extremely important in your life? Don't do it. Don't even do it. Because there's nothing to dread in coming to God. Nothing whatsoever. He's fantastic. He's loving. All of the suspicions in our heart about God are full of crap. And so I would urge you to do that tonight. Then you should come back next week and keep studying Genesis, because all of these questions are going to be answered right there, and that's what this book's about, as a matter of fact. Coming to know God and what He's like, all of those things. It's pretty cool. Next week, then, we'll start in chapter 2 and read the detailed description of what does it mean to be created in the image of God. He gives us 7 or 8 features that show us, basically, this is what it means. And I think you'll bear witness to what's said there. It's very convincing. This is what humans are. All right. I'm going to take some questions now, or comments from you guys.
I've thought about these things before. I mean, it's been a while, so I appreciate your topic. But a sticking point that I have in my own thought at times is whether, you know, I've come to a point where I feel, where I've thought this before, that maybe society, you know, here, I think you said we have a meaningful, significant, free, and moral being. But could it be that, you know, my significance, my morality, the fact of my freedom and so forth is because of society that has evolved out of, you know, whatever? Could that be an answer?
I don't think the presence of society could account for freedom in any way. It could account for morality. A lot of people believe that morality is socially constructed so that society basically decides certain things are right and certain things are wrong. Now, we need to admit that that's often true, and this accounts for why you see different moral definitions in different cultures. But what we're doing is looking past that and asking ourselves, aside from the specific moral norms that different cultures come up with, is there such a thing as morality in the global sense? Is it possible to describe anything that would pretty much always be wrong? And there, I think that if we're honest again with ourselves, we have to answer, yes, there are these things. Yes, there is morality that is transcultural. And, you know, a lot of cultures, we talk about raping and killing a child. Mm-hmm. You know, there are cultures where that's permissible. As long as it's a slave child, you can do what you want. And there's nothing wrong with that. So what are we saying, though, and a lot of people really camp out on this social construction of morality thing. Are we saying, therefore, it really is okay for them to do that? Because that's their cultural norm? I can't buy that. I don't think any of us do. I think we would say this is a corrupt culture that has a very mistaken perspective on that point, probably like our culture does on other points as well. We've been right there, after all. And we still have a lot of problems. I think that to say that our sense of morality is colored by the culture we're in doesn't really get at the more central question of the fact that humans have what we call moral motions, that we all sense in every culture that there must be such a thing as moral right and wrong. And that is really the point that we have to give away if we go with a naturalistic worldview, because it's all imaginary at that point. There is no such thing as something that's truly morally right or wrong. How about back here?
I think you made a lot of really important points, and I just kind of wanted to add a little asterisk of something that God showed me. I majored in postmodern, deconstructionalist, feminist literary criticism.
Oh, wow.
At OSU.
Well, you've been all over this then.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm real familiar with the guy on the railroad argument, and even some more that are, you know, really complex and start bringing in physics and stuff. But I found that I was not persuaded into the kingdom by many of these arguments. We do need to understand. And when I became a believer, I tried very hard to share the truth that I knew in an argumentative way, because that's how I was trained. And I didn't win anybody for the kingdom which was very difficult for me to deal with, because I was like, but this is true, so why is nobody accepting this? And so, you know, while I definitely think this is critical, we need an understanding of this. Truth is absolute. It is out there. You can know it. I have just found personally that God has really shown me I have always got to come hand in hand with that, with Schaefer's final apologetic, which is love. You know, and I'm getting into, yeah, and I'm going to make my next point, and I've got this next thing I'm going to hammer you with. I'm not concerned with the soul of the person that I'm reaching out to. And that is clearly communicated. So I just want to be really clear. You know, I'm not saying this isn't important. It is critical that we understand this. Everything you said is true. And it's a beautiful thing that God has revealed to us. But something that he really took me to task over was, you know, where's your heart? Are you wanting to win this argument? Or do you want to love this person the way that I'm loving you?
Yeah. That's, you know, yeah, I agree with your points. And I think that personally, I am comforted to know that I don't have to be inconsistent or pretend that certain things are true when I inwardly know or sense that they're not true. And that strengthens my faith greatly because of that. When I look at the internal consistency, for instance, of the Christian worldview, I'm so happy that it's that way. Now, as far as people coming to Christ in the first place, actually few people come to Christ, as you pointed out, because of wanting to be more consistent in their worldview. I suppose they should, and some do. There are those who do. But all of us, I think, can feel good that once we come to Christ, and it may be because of the aching, you know, emptiness in my heart, that I feel like I need God in my life, you know, and that I don't want to be lonely anymore, and that I don't understand why I'm this way, and I want to change, and God changes lives, and those are all pretty valid reasons for coming to God. And it may be then that the importance of this idea of our worldview comes home to us after we're Christians, because we start to realize, you know, I had this thing where I was kind of desperate and I came to God and stuff like that. And it was really sometime after that, in my reading and so forth, I started to realize, so wait a minute, so wow, so this is really true. You know, and it's like we can kind of take quantum steps upward in our own faith the more we start to realize, so it has to be this way, basically. It's really built into the architecture of humans and of the universe. It's pretty exciting. And it's given me a lot more strength in my Christian walk to realize that. Let's go one more up here.
That was great, Dennis. I was thinking that most people I do know do believe in a God. And I used to believe there was a God, too. And remember then sitting in church at a funeral of a friend of mine in eighth grade, when it was all the questioning, well, how do I know? You know, I realized I was not sure of where she was going after she died or where I was going, just because I believed in a God, I did not have that surety until I was told about Christ being taking the penalty for my sins, and that I was an imperfect person, so I couldn't go to an imperfect God. And that just totally, that's what changed my life, when I decided to accept Christ as the mediator between me and God, and what he did for me, accept his gift that he did for our sins. But just believing in the God didn't do it, but it's the accepting Christ is what really made the difference for me.
Right, and your point's important. Believing in a God is not enough. There's also the issue of forming a relationship with him, and that needs, and he's basically done all that's necessary to do that. And this is where Christ comes in, as that's what he's done about it. So we're going to be studying that in Genesis, and I hope people will be willing to stick with this study for a few weeks through some rough sledding here, because there's where, when we come out of the cave into the sunlight, that's what it's all about. It turns out that this whole thing was set up, and that God has a plan for all of us that centers around his kind of rescue mission for the human race that, was carried out in Christ. Why don't we turn to him right now and pray? Heavenly Father, looking at this text tonight and thinking more and more deeply about ourselves and what we see inside of ourselves, we realize that you're really there, that you are real. And God, if you are there and you've created such high order beings, personal beings as us, that must be because there's an expectation of some sort of contact and communication between us. In fact, a relationship. That's what being personal is all about, is relationship. And so we realize, God, that you have created us and you've put us here and that you've communicated to us and that you want to know us. This is pretty exciting stuff. This is life-changing stuff. And tonight, God, I want to pray for any that have come out to join us here who are curious, who are considering the possibility of getting involved with you, that they would do what we mentioned earlier tonight and just call out to you in their own heart tonight and ask you to show them that you're there, that you're real, and that they can know you. Lord, it is so exciting when we start realizing that you've spoken to us, that we have real revelation here. When we start realizing that we can have this relationship with you, that we can grow spiritually in this life, when we start realizing that you change lives and that you can repair a lot of the damage in our lives, and then when we start realizing, God, that life does go on and there is life after death and we can be with you forever. These are the most important things that could ever be realized, God. So we just feel real thankful tonight that you've decided to create us and that you've decided to give us the insight we need to be able to come to you. And pray that in Christ's name. Amen.